Good question. One difference is
that... Do you want to repeat the question a little bit? I'm not sure.
Yeah, so basically the question is, what's different between Newton, who is developing these nice mathematical models, making predictions against the observations, refining his models, and so on, and then his making some statements about, well, now we can understand perhaps things about how God works in creation like this or like that, versus Dawkins, who thinks that, well, you know, you look at what the evolutionary biologists are doing, you look at the cosmologists, and they say, ah, God probably doesn't exist, right? So they both eventually connect something up about their understanding of science with God. One key difference between them is that Newton is explicit about the fact that those are two different kinds of projects. And you can't say anything about God's relationship to creation without first asking something about theologically who God is, and on the other hand, trying to understand something about what's the nature of the creation that he's made. So he's very explicit in his notebooks and in his letters that these are two different kinds of project. One's a natural philosophy project, one's a theological project, and he was interested in doing both, but he keeps a kind of clear separation from them, although he recognizes that they also overlap because they both tell you something about God. Dawkins, on the other hand, doesn't recognize that there is any sort of borderline or any distinction between a theological question and understanding on the one hand, and a scientific question and understanding something about the nature of some processes that are involved, say, in cellular biology or something like that, or Big Bang cosmology. So that's one sort of key difference between the two of them. A difference in terms of whether or not one recognizes that I'm engaged in two separate kinds of projects that can be related to each other in some fruitful way versus there's one project and it doesn't have any room for God. Another kind of difference, I would say, is that Newton also understands that clearly that he's working within a kind of Christian framework that makes the understanding and the meaning of the scientific practices clear for him in terms of the kind of purposes of understanding the nature of the secondary causes that are at work in creation and then how God might be at work through those causes. For Dawkins, he takes it that, no, actually, and this is a kind of, on Dawkins' part, is a misreading of history, or maybe just a lack of understanding of the actual history of the development of scientific practices, but that science basically only makes sense within a kind of naturalistic worldview. So he's already got a metaphysical commitment, and that science then somehow vindicates that commitment because it somehow produces evidence that supports his initial kind of commitment. He, of course, doesn't say it that way. He makes it sound a bit more like, well, we just empirically discover, right, that there's no God, right, something like that in a kind of crude sort of way. So he's actually looking for a kind of vindication of his view. As a point of sort of difference in emphasis, Newton's really interested in understanding, okay, how does creation work? And then I can ask this question about its relationship to God. But the purposes look to be quite different. And those probably do track back to the fact that you've got two different kinds of theologies, ultimately, or worldviews, if you will, that are sort of framing overall how they both approach thinking about scientific work and what it might mean, what its significance might be. Catherine?
I have a follow-up question to that. Do you think that one's metaphysical or worldview kind of commitments are always prior in this case? I mean, or is there feedback between, you know, one's view of methodological practice and the metaphysical practice? So like in the Dawkins and Newton case, they each seem to have their own religious commitment before they start making conclusions. Do you see any feedback there?
That's also a good question, right? So the idea of is there some sort of deep connection between a worldview commitment on the one hand and then one's approach to science and then perhaps feeding back to that commitment. And I want to say yes in at least a particular sense. I mean, there's no way we can sort of do anything without some larger set of commitments. We may not be aware of all, well, actually we aren't aware of all of our commitments, but we might be aware of some of our commitments to a kind of a sense or a picture of, you know, what the real world is like. So that's, I think, is inescapable. Then the question is, how much does that actually either affect the way that we think about the scientific investigation of the world and what various sorts of scientific results might mean, and then what kind of openness we might have to perhaps having our worldview affirmed or maybe challenged, right? I mean, a feedback loop in principle could open up a variety of responses. I would say that Dawkins doesn't seem to be open at all to having his worldview challenged by anything that sort of comes along the science pipeline. And that perhaps is the way a lot of people maybe operate, because they assume that there's something kind of prior about the metaphysical or theological commitments in the worldview, and that everything somehow has to be read in terms of that. But I think the healthier way of thinking about that is that I should always be open to perhaps being challenged by something that I might learn from the sciences in terms of going back and thinking about my theological view or my sort of larger worldview. Does that sharpen something about my worldview commitment? Or does that perhaps challenge something? Maybe there's something that's goofed up in my worldview, and something that I'm seeing in the sciences is kind of laying a finger on that, and I need to sort of, you know, go through and sort that and see if I can come to an understanding of what's going on there. And do I have a problem or do I not have a problem? But that requires a kind of extra step of reflectivity and is a lot more work than simply sticking with a prior set of commitments and sort of making sure that everything that I see somehow fits in to those commitments, and not allowing, you know, sort of anything to escape the kind of blinders that commitment creates for me. That also that does require a little bit of work, because I have to sort of interpret everything in a particular sort of way so that nothing upsets the apple cart. So I'm not sure if that actually requires less work or more work than being open to being challenged. But I don't get into some identity commitment issues, right, where, you know, if something starts to perhaps press on my identity as a person because I'm sort of wrapped up around particular sorts of worldview commitments by sort of constantly always interpreting the thing to be consistent with my worldview commitments, I don't ever get that kind of challenge. So it's safer maybe that way. Dawkins isn't the only one who does this, of course. I mean, all of us can probably think of sectors of Christianity that practice the same sort of thing, like wall off any possible results that might be contrary to a particular kind of theological framing of things, and then just proceed forward. But I think, you know, it is inescapable that we're always working with some sort of worldview theological commitments. The real issue, I think, is how much do we reflect on the fact that there should be some kind of two-way street there between our experience in the world and the commitments that we are, you know, find ourselves bringing to that experience.
I'm sorry if you talked about this before I arrived, but what did you think about miracles?
What did Newton think about miracles? Well, he was for them. So Newton has actually a pretty sophisticated kind of view. We tend to think about Newton as being attached to this sort of the Newtonian picture of the world like a clockwork. And he does think that there are some things that work kind of clock-like in that. But Newton actually was not a Newtonian. In the sense that we typically think of how the 18th century Newtonian worldview works. Sure, there's a lot of mechanical stuff going on in the universe, and he gives us a prescription in the Principia to try to figure out all the forces. It's actually a theory of everything, actually, right? You've got Newton's equation of motion, and a lot of the Principia is trying to teach you how that you just go through and you can systematically find all the forces, right, to plug into that equation, and then you got a theory of everything. Except the everything for Newton is a bit limited, because he thinks, for example, that the solar system is not a clockwork that God can just start up and then forever and ever it will run. He thinks that actually the universe, well, for him, the solar system plus the stars, that is the universe, right? It's a tiny universe compared to what we think, but for them, it was vast for them. But they would not, well, we can't comprehend how big our universe is, but they would be blown away by the comparison between, you know, what Newton thought the universe was and what we think it is now. Right? But he did not think that that universe would, you know, just act perpetually in a kind of regular clockwork fashion. It would actually run down, and God would from time to time have to come in and sort of, you know, start it back up again, set things right, and so on. Turns out that in 1998, a couple of clever physicists were able to show by computer simulation that yes, indeed, the solar system is chaotic. It will eventually go into a sad state of repair. There's a question about whether that will happen before or after the sun, you know, has its kind of death throes. But Newton, turns out his intuition was right. The solar system is not a clockwork kind of thing. It will, if left to itself, actually run down, in a sense. Newton also did not think that his physics was deterministic, that somehow the equations of motion and the forces would basically determine how all of the material particles would work for ad infinitum and so forth. He's a decided minority on that point with respect to everybody else's interpretation of his views. So in that sense, Newton has some very different intuitions about his own work. He also thought he was, you know, the greatest scientist of all time. And there's some justification for thinking, but he had a huge ego. Every famous 17th century natural philosopher scientist had huge egos. It was the age of huge ego. Well, I don't know. We probably aren't out of that age even now, right? But he still had this sense, which likely is very much theologically informed in terms of his thinking about who God is, how God's related to creation, God's purposes for creation, that my scientific understanding of the world can't be the complete, exhaustive understanding of how things are working. Get to somebody like Laplace, and Laplace says, no, actually, they probably can do this. Quick example there. I mean, Newton does get to the point where he says, actually, to create the solar system, there's sort of no way that that can just happen naturally. God has to sort of set it up and get it going. And Laplace comes along with some help from Kant, who is the first person to articulate what we call the nebular hypothesis, that if you take a huge enough cloud of gas and you apply Newton's laws of motion and the force of gravity, you can show how it would collapse and form a sun at the center and planets around it. So Laplace, you know, gives a pretty nice worked out version of the, well, as worked out as you could for that time period. That's mathematically a very hard problem. But he works that and shows that, see, you don't need a creator to create the universe. You can actually start at a much, you know, a kind of prior point and actually have it emerge according to the principles that Newton has taught us. Contrary to popular belief, Laplace did not say in a reported conversation with Napoleon that I have no need of that hypothesis. As when Napoleon asked him, where's God? That report comes from some cook who was overhearing a conversation, and we have no actual records. Laplace actually thought you needed some kind of being, some initial creator to somehow get the whole thing going. That's a pretty popular belief up until late 19th century. But God doesn't need to do anything else once he's got it started. That's a strand of deism that's very popular in the 18th and most of the 19th centuries. So that's to say that Newton has when you, at least in hindsight, he's got some pretty healthy understandings of the limits of the scientific system that he's created. And part of that understanding of the limits probably is his balancing between understanding the nature of creation, but also trying to understand the nature of the Creator and God's relationship to creation. Randy?
I just wondered if you could talk a little bit about some alternatives or the opposites of methodological naturalism. I mean, you did go in one direction and talked a little bit about the metaphysical naturalism. How about the other side, thinking a little bit about methodological supernaturalism? What would that look like, but from your background, are there any historical examples of where something we might call methodological supernaturalism might have actually been successful or been helpful in understanding? I mean, if you don't have MN, what do you have?
Right, so instead of, well, one way to move from methodological naturalism is in the direction of, it's all going to be metaphysically naturalistic and we just deal with it. The other way is to say, well, let's just open the floodgates to all, you know, it's all supernatural, right? That's your methodological supernaturalism, I take it. Right, okay, so am I aware of any successful accounts of methodological supernaturalism? No. Am I aware of actually of any accounts where somebody has tried to say that, well, it's all basically supernatural? Well, in a sense, you can talk about Malebranche, Descartes, even Jonathan Edwards, who have this idea of continuous creation, right? That God recreates the world moment by moment, such that at each instant, you can think they're just each time slice that's created, things fit together in this coherent fashion such that the sentence I'm speaking actually makes sense to you, right? Even though that sentence is punctuated by, who knows, like billions of creation events, right? That sort of thing. That would be a view that I think would be fair to characterize as a kind of methodological supernaturalism, because basically God does everything in that view. Now, the judgment about whether or not those views are successful depend upon a whole lot of factors about whether you think the kind of philosophical systems these gentlemen built really works. Do they have a good understanding of science? Is their understanding of the sciences consistent with this continuous creation kind of view? That's one candidate maybe for a kind of methodological supernaturalism. That, of course, has various implications. I mean, no human free will, for instance, there. There's no freedom for creation to sort of be co-participant with God in terms of becoming fully what it's intended to be in Christ, and various other sorts of implications. So there are some possible worries you might raise, perhaps, about any kind of methodological supernaturalism view. Does it leave room, for instance, for something about human free will, for example.
So then why is there still, or there appears to be, or maybe wrong, a strong current of opposition to methodological naturalism in the Christian community?
I think part of it is that a lot of people are they're confused on being able to sort of properly separate out methodological naturalism as a commitment to being able to ask and answer particular kinds of questions in particular ways versus something that's got more substantial metaphysical commitments to it. So like the like in this slide here, it's almost as if people are not able to sort of clearly separate out what's methodology, which has to do with things like there are particular things I want to know, what are the best ways to go about knowing and understanding those things, versus what needs to be, in some metaphysical sense, all the set of players that can possibly be at work in the world, for instance. That's going to have some impact on the kinds of questions you might want to ask and answer. So I think one reason why at least the Christian community in particular seems to struggle with methodological naturalism is we're not really clear on what it is, in some sense. Another that another reason why I think we're not, I need to go back to the last slide, why I think we have some struggles with this is that if we're not clear on being able to sort of separate out some form of methodological naturalism from some form of metaphysical or ontological naturalism, then we're not really able to think about what are the practices of sciences versus what are the metaphysical, possible metaphysical commitments of scientists or science as a enterprise. Now you have to have like capital S science as an enterprise, right? That's an abstraction because what we have are sciences and they have their differences and so on. But if you try and lump them all together and think about this enterprise of science, that looks to a lot of people like it's a kind of boogeyman, right? That's coming in to do this dirty work here I have on the slide of, you know, get rid of God and slay the beast of Christianity and then everybody will live happily ever after in this materialist heaven, right? Something like that. Well, that's what that's the kind of picture that Sam Harris and some of these atheist writers seem to indicate, right? Well, we see that as a community, and we get all up in arms about that because that just can't be right, so we think. And then we trip over the fact about, well, is it the sciences that are pushing in this antagonistic direction, right? Or is it actually a set of metaphysical commitments that have people driving in this direction? And then science or the sciences become, if you will, a kind of bludgeon that's being used to kind of beat people over. And, you know, do that enough, and we're going to start reacting against the bludgeon as well as the bludgeoner, if you will. So I think that also plays into our, the ways in which we react to the sciences. And part of what I try to argue in my classes and in some places where I've published on these topics is that we need to sort of clearly separate out what is it that the everyday scientist does when he or she is trying to figure out, you know, okay, so how far away is that supernova? Wow, 10 billion light years away. I love showing pictures like that to me. It's eye-popping to them, right? Okay, well, we can do those sorts of things without having to immerse ourselves in the fact, oh, well, that must imply that God doesn't exist. I mean, there's a non sequitur there, right? What fills in the blanks? Well, it's a particular metaphysical commitment, right? So the typical bench scientist is actually not thinking about what's this mean for God. They're trying to do what Newton sort of taught us to do, trying to think about how does this work? What's the answer to my question? How far away is that? How bright is that star, for example? How does reproduction work in this organism? And so forth. Right? Again, that's what I mean by mundane questions. And sometimes we either, in the Christian community, we confuse those questions, or the atheists obviously often confuse those questions. And so they want to take mundane answers from science and then draw these world-shattering conclusions from them. Lauren?
So I'm going to try and channel Alvin Plantinga a little bit here. Yes, you give a good account for why Christians should engage in science and look for natural causes and effects. Most of the time, that's good theological reasons for that. But Christians believe that God doesn't always work that way, right? In salvation history, we believe God did miracles. God can do miracles. So Christians have available certain modes of explanation that atheists don't, which we can employ. Now, I'm not saying that every scientific miracle should be called upon that way. You know what? How do monarch butterflies migrate to the same spot every year? Or how does a tree grow from an acorn? There's some things we don't understand, and I'm not saying we should invoke miracles there. Or not even necessarily in sort of one-time mysteries like, you know, we don't know everything about how the earth got all this water from comets or outgassing. You know, we'll use, but when it comes to biological evolution, for example, and the mysteries of things that aren't fully explained about complexity and new life forms, why is that a case where we should restrict ourselves to natural explanations when we also have available to ourselves this other way that God can act?
Well, my response to that is, what question do you want to ask?
What would you say if I say, I think some of those mysteries are better explained by God performing miraculous actions? And I'm assuming you want to say, no, actually, let's keep investigating those, expecting them to be solved by natural mechanisms. Why should I follow you on that?
Well, I might wonder why you should bother me up on that as well. But I would say, so what do you mean by a miracle?
Something that happens outside of our normally understood. I mean, there are times when we could say, I don't know if this was a God acting especially through natural causes, or times when things are violating, but you know, if somebody's walking on water, clearly that's not happening by the laws of physics, it's a miracle. So something like that, something which violates the normal natural causes.
Yeah, and I'm quite happy with Jesus walking the water as being a miracle, quite happy with the resurrection being a miracle. Although I did have a conversation with somebody recently and thought, well, no, maybe that could happen in a way where God works through natural processes. Well, maybe, but the key there is that, you know, God is not absent from that. And indeed, that's part of my answer would be that, well, even if we continue pressing on, trying to see, okay, so are there a set of secondary causes that lead to, you know, the creation of new species, as one example where people might have a question about, well, do we need a miraculous intervention here or not, is that God is not absent from what the scientists might be trying to tell us about how that process unfolds. Indeed, I might want to ask, I mean, well, for example, we talk about the miracle of birth, right? It's I don't know that this is a you know, uniform, that every parent at the first and perhaps further births always says, oh, what a miracle, right? But we talk about the miracle of life a whole lot in that context. Yet we know an awful lot about sort of how that process works. And we can take, you know, a clue from David in the Psalm, Psalm 139, 13, where he says, you know, you wove me together in my mother's womb. It's not like people, well, they didn't know the biology we know now, but they also know that, you know, there's a kind of ordered, normal process that happens, takes, you know, on average about 9 months, and so forth. So what's being implied there? Well, it's not, there's nothing, that, I mean, David's not saying that, there's something that happens outside the natural order. Instead, he's saying there's something about that God is always in work in this process. So the idea, I think, or one premise that lies behind this move to say that, well, sometimes we need to allow for miracles where the, you know, the scientist is just going to come up short, is an underlying assumption that God either works by means that come from outside the laws of nature, completely unmediated by the elements of creation that God made for his own purposes, or things just happen with natural processes working the way they normally do with no divine intervention whatsoever. That's a false dichotomy, I would submit, just reference you to Psalm 104, as a good example of why there's at least one other option on the table for how, say, creation and God cooperate together in the way that they work. So is our desire to sometimes say that, well, you know, the scientists should really look at a miracle here, as opposed to see, okay, so what are the potentialities, the possibilities of creation itself, given the kind of nature that we can discover it has, without also ruling out the fact that God may be at work in that process. The scientist can see sort of the natural side of that process, but maybe the theologian with biblical eyes can see something into the divine side of that process. Right, so that would be one sort of question and sort of line of response I would have, is to, you know, is the desire to sometimes invoke miracles in a scientific context, is that well motivated actually theologically, or at least as well motivated as we kind of initially think, because there is an attraction to that, because we know that biblically there are some miracles that did happen. I mean, let's face it, axe heads that sink to the bottom of a lake do not float up when you throw some, sprinkle some dust on the water, right? But that happened at least once in Elisha's ministry, right? Something like that. Okay, that is not going to have an explanation, we think, in terms of the processes of nature. There's always the possibility, right, that we might learn something tomorrow that revises our judgments about that. So scientists always make provisional statements on these things. It's only some people that, people like Richard Dawkins, I know, that sort of white knuckle the results as if, no, this is actually not revisable, but generally, scientists realize that they're dealing with provisional kinds of truths and not absolute certainties. A commitment to empiricism sort of takes the certainties aspect away from you. You can't get there without omniscience, and you don't have that, right? So that's sort of one response. The other is, it's related in the sense that it moves in a theological direction. Are we thereby making a statement about something about the nature of God's creation, that somehow it's inadequate, it's not up to the task of fulfilling all of the kind of, if I can put it this way, ministerial functions that God may have given to it to support life, for instance? Again, not with God sort of sitting off just watching, but support life with God at work in the midst of that. So again, I think we should sort of step back, particularly for Christians, this is important for us, to think about, if I got everything on the table theologically and biblically that I really should have before I start then asking about, do we really need a miracle here in the sense of something that comes from completely outside, completely unmediated, or not? And I don't think those are nearly as simple questions as sometimes we fall into thinking that they are. Not that I want to accuse Al of simple-minded thinking. He's a deep thinker, right? So you may not have really channeled him as fully as, but I think that, it represents a question I think Christians often ask, though, about, well, why not appeal to miracles? Because this looks like we need one here, right? Something like that. Catherine? Ah, that's good. Good question. So, methodological naturalism outside of the natural sciences. My short answer to that is I don't think you can make sense of methodological naturalism outside of the natural sciences. I can give you an article that I've written on that subject in terms of the context of psychology and the social sciences. If you're interested, just let me know. I guess that includes the listeners out on the web, too, but in principle, I guess. It does. Now I'll be getting, who knows, 5 requests or something.
Make sure you're flipped.
Right. But, so if you go back to this, what I think is a kind of founding theological idea in at least what I'll say is the pre-20th century way of sort of thinking about methodological naturalism, and that's that the key idea is to try to understand some phenomena on its own terms, right? So think about the psychologist who wants to do a study maybe about religious commitment, or a sociologist wants to do a study about religious, right? But something about things like religious commitment, or how it is that the image of God functions in people's lives, so on and so forth. There are psychological studies of these things. You can find articles on it. If you're going to take a kind of methodological naturalist view, at least the way that we think of it in a contemporary way now, is to say, I have to rule out, or pretend as if God doesn't exist, right? Now I'm going to study my research subjects who, let's say that they're all, we have some measure of commitment, they're all sort of, one research study I think of that was done in Italy drew on committed Catholics and priests, right? Folks who, if you would give them some survey measure about, are they really seriously religiously committed people, right, they'd score very high on this. Right, but now you have to set up your study such that you pretend that God doesn't exist, right? But these, your study subjects, they don't pretend like that at all. For them, God is their Father. Jesus is their Savior. The Spirit is the one who inhabits their lives and enables them to serve God on a daily basis, so on and so forth. I mean, they have a completely different view about what God means and God's reality in their lives. Otherwise, they wouldn't be the committed people that they are. Right. So now if you're trying to follow this idea that we have, right, like I have up here on this previous slide of, well, we have to, you know, we have to invoke a rule now in our study that God doesn't exist, and we have to only look for particular kinds of material, or generalize it to natural causes. Now I got to do this analysis on, you know, my study subjects in this way. I've basically removed the thing that makes the difference for why they live the lives the way that they do versus living some other kind of life. So I've already sort of deeply distorted the phenomena that I'm trying to study in terms of my research subjects. Whereas if I step back and I take the view that, well, what I need to do is try to study the phenomena on its own terms, then I would forget all the stuff on this slide, and I would say, okay, so these guys take God very seriously. I need to understand something about the nature of God as they understand God, and then try to conduct my study in such a way that I bring that understanding all the way through, so I can figure, okay, so what makes these people tick? Why do they do what they do? And then what are the, you know, kind of the statistical characteristics I can pull out, you know, because the psychology journals require you to have all the statistics in there, right? That's a whole other story, right? But that's a very different way to do the psychology study, and the second way would not be acceptable for the journals, by and large, unless it's a journal for the scientific study of religion or something like this, right? But a kind of focused, your typical sort of focused psychology journal would probably not accept a paper that actually tried to study these Catholic priests and nuns on their own terms taking God seriously. You would have to do it the first version that I sketched, where you pretend God isn't there and this is just a kind of construct for them and off you go. So that's to suggest that when we turn to things like the studies of human beings in societies, whether it's history or the social sciences and so on, we can't do some of the same things that people think we can do with the natural sciences, because for human beings, our conception of God really matters to us. The relationship we have with God really matters to us. For electrons, it doesn't matter what they believe about God. They don't have beliefs. Volcanoes, it's not an issue, right? So there's something. Well, that suggests that there's something that's actually distinctly different about the natural science modes of inquiry and the sort of subjects or topics the natural scientist picks on versus what happens in social or human inquiry. And that difference really does show up in this attempt to make a kind of analog, say, to methodological naturalism in the arena of human inquiry, right? So that's actually a very good question, because you will see people talk of, I mean, there are discussions among historians about methodological naturalism, and their discussions actually exhibit exactly these problems that I sketched in terms of the, you know, the two ways you could do this psychology study.
How about one more question here?
Sure.
For you. In the June issue, our journal, Bruce Gordon published the article titled "In Defense of Uniformitarianism." Now, if I understand him right, and I'd like to clarify, and you have to respond to that, he seems to be saying is, why don't we as Christians really advocate uniformitarianism rather than methodological naturalism? Because it seems to have all the positive benefits, the focus on homogeneity, consistency, of God's working in through nature, blah, blah, blah. Allows you to do science, while it really avoids that dangerously close liaison that MN has with metaphysical naturalism and that sort. So what, I don't know if I understood it right, but could you comment on uniformitarianism versus methodological naturalism?
Yeah, so as I understand that, that I think is a good, that's an understanding of Bruce Gordon's position, as I would understand, that methodological naturalism has this baggage to it, baggage that's exhibited by some of the exemplars here on the screen. By the way, this is Bruce's formulation right here, so he can't actually see what I'm pointing to. Unless you're recording, then you'll have the slides up.
We'll get it, we'll get it.
But in any event, right, so right, so it has this kind of baggage, meaning, you know, extracting it from this metaphysical turn is, you know, perhaps too big a task. If, you know, we won't be able to do that, right? But so let's turn to uniformitarianism, because that emphasizes the ideas of things like a kind of continuity and a homogeneity to the, say, the order of creation and so on and so forth. But uniformitarianism also has its baggage from 19th century debates and that's been then exasperated in the 20th century by numbers of Christians saying that uniformitarianism is just this metaphysical kind of naturalist view, right? So actually, I think if one sort of scores the accounting, neither term does particularly well on the baggage ring. They both would you know, they would get really large check baggage fees, right, flying on the airplanes, right? So this, I don't think, is going to be sort of a successful way to adjudicate, well, which term should we try to resurrect? There is another kind of feature, though, is to say that, well, you know, I mean, we talk a lot about methodological naturalism, but who is it that talks about methodological naturalism, for example? Well, those who want to, well, one group of people who seem to do this are those who are clearly trying to argue either that there's something false about the sciences or that the sciences are inadequate, right? So there's a group of Christian writers, I will say, who see attacking methodological naturalism as an appropriate way of showing that, see, we've got these problems that science is closed off from allowing God in. I mean, just reference these four quotes here, and when we restrict ourselves from allowing God in the picture, then we, you know, we restrict ourselves from the full range of possible adequate explanations for how things happen in creation. Right, so that's one group who talks about that. So there, methodological naturalism enters into the debates as a means for trying to critique the sciences. Another group turned out to be people like me and Catherine and Lauren, who for whatever reasons either are presented with the opportunity or feel compelled to try and respond and say, no, actually, this is not the right way for Christians to think about these things. Right, so that's another group who writes about methodological naturalism. I'd be happy if I never wrote another paper about methodological naturalism again, but... you know, invitations keep coming, and I, for some reason, have a hard time saying no. All right, well, that's a second group. A third group that I know of who sometimes will talk about methodological naturalism will be what I like to call evidentialist atheists, but sometimes are called new atheists. They're not new, they're just 19th century reruns in some sense. And if you look at what's going on in the 19th century, you can see that, I mean, it's just a return of the 19th century in some interesting but disturbing ways. Well, they also write about methodological naturalism, but they use it in the reverse sense to sort of, you know, whomp the, you know, these Christian Luddites over the head, you know, in terms of their conception of their enemy. Right, so those are sort of the three groups of people who talk about methodological naturalism. If you set those three groups aside and you turn to the, you know, to the scientists in, you know, the normal sort of journals, you look at their textbooks, you look at their monographs, you don't find them talking about methodological naturalism. what you talk find them talking about is, you know, what sort of adequate practices do we use? What's effective? And here are the results, you know, from the way I approached trying to answer this particular question. They might every now and then tell you what was wrong with another approach that they tried previously, but that often doesn't appear in the journals. That's in the notebooks somewhere that somebody might check later, right? But they give you an account of why the published results worked out the way that they did, and some perspectives about what they will do next in light of this, right? And off they go. Right, you don't see a discussion about methodology. They don't start a paper and say, by the way, I just want everybody to know that I am not invoking God in this paper. Right, or, you know, I'm pretending that God doesn't exist, etc., etc., right? That doesn't happen.
I've never seen that in the methods section of a paper.
right. So this doesn't happen in the methods sections. It doesn't happen anywhere. So I think that suggests that there must be some kind of motivating factor or factors as to why particular groups end up, you know, invoking methodological naturalism in writing about it, whereas the average scientist has no interest in the topic and doesn't probably think that they're doing anything that has the kind of ramifications that the methodological naturalism debates seem to attribute to that. So I know the motivation for why I and some people who are always responding to talk about methodological naturalism, why we write the way that we do, and I have a pretty good understanding, I think, of why the atheists who talk about it write the way that they do, and I think we could probably figure out why the other group of Christians use methodological naturalism to write the way that they do, because they have particular objectives about how they want to show that the normal way of doing science that Christians actually developed and bequeathed to us somehow forecloses the possibility for particular kinds of explanations, when I think Newton would probably be a little puzzled by it and wonder and think that, well, I don't see how I'm foreclosing anything. I think he would find today's debates really, you know, sort of somehow wrong-headed, off track, missed the mark somehow.
All right, let's see.